You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tig Enright, and Victoria Graham.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with Amanda Goodall of the Cass Business School. Amanda, what do you have for us today?
I have the Greenpeace Arctic 30 who have just received bail. I'm also going to mention a story about breast cancer rates and about mammograms. And finally, we're back to bankers, I'm afraid. The Co-op Bank this time again.
More from Amanda later. Also ahead, so-called price tagging by Israeli settlers is on the rise again against Palestinians. We ask if these small criminal acts could derail the broader peace process. We get both sides of the argument later, live from Ramallah.
They see themselves as a militia that can come instead of the army when the army can't act. The government at the moment doesn't see eye to eye with them, which means their movement will develop.
Also ahead, part four of our week-long series on soft power to coincide with Monocle's 2013 Soft Power Survey. Today we're in Spain, which, by establishing several high-profile prizes, is hoping to boost its soft power credentials.
Spain has been a very global country in many reasons. Like, our language is one of the top languages in the world. Our culture has influence in, you know, big parts of, you know, South America, Central America, you know, Southeast Asia. The global projection of Spain, I think, is a strong value that is reflected on this award too.
And before the end of the programme, e-readers might be on the rise, but we ask whether the art of the bookbinder is entering a golden age.
All of that we'll check in with our team in Helsinki ahead of a special edition of The Briefing from the city later today. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But before all that, we catch up on the latest world news with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. French authorities have named the man they've arrested on suspicion of carrying out a series of gun attacks in Paris. Abdelhakim Dekar was arrested in a car park in the northwest of the city on Wednesday evening following a tip-off from the public. In 1998, he was jailed for 4 years for his involvement in a series of fatal shootings in Paris linked to an anarchist group. He's suspected of threatening a TV station last Friday and attacking a bank and a newspaper office on Monday. Thousands of Afghan elders are meeting in Kabul to discuss the country's future relations with the United States. America's threatening to withdraw all staff, not just combat forces, at the end of next year unless Afghan officials agree to give them immunity from prosecution. There have been days of tense negotiations before today's Loya Jirga, and it's being reported that agreement has been reached. Speaking before the meeting, Secretary of State John Kerry again insisted it's for the people of Afghanistan to determine its future. And he rejected claims that Hamid Karzai had asked for a formal admission of American mistakes.
It's up to the people of Afghanistan. It has to go to the Loya Jirga. There were some people who may have questioned or doubted whether that was going to happen. Well, it's happening. But let me be clear. President Karzai didn't ask for an apology. There was no discussion of an apology. He didn't ask for it. We're not discussing it.
Talks resume today between world powers and Iran on the country's nuclear program. Tehran's being offered limited sanctions relief in exchange for a deal to restrict its nuclear program. Since the election of President Rouhani earlier this year, Iran has adopted a softer approach. But yesterday, the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, warned that he won't give up the country's right to atomic enrichment work. Iranian journalist and commentator Mehrad Vahizinejad told The Globalist that not much should be read into that change in tone.
They too in Iran have to sort of play this good cop, bad cop. So you have Rouhani and his foreign minister Zarif as, on the one side, and then you need someone having this very, you know, let's say hard stance saying that we're not gonna step back even for 1 second. And I don't think many people will take it seriously and think that it has more domestic audience.
There's tight security outside Australia's embassy in Jakarta, where protesters have gathered amidst growing anger over reports that Canberra spied on top Indonesians, including the president and his wife. Relations between the key trading and strategic neighbours have slumped to their lowest ebb since 1999 after this week's media reports that Australia's spy agency had tried to tap President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono's mobile phone and those of his wife and senior officials in 2009. Australia's Foreign Minister Julie Bishop has refused to discuss the reports. Speaking at a news conference in Washington after meeting her US counterpart John Kerry, she said it wasn't her place to discuss issues related to intelligence gathering.
We do not discuss intelligence matters, certainly not allegations. We do not discuss them publicly, and we will not do so. The Prime Minister has made two statements to the Parliament now on this issue, and I would refer you to those statements.
It's being reported that North Korea appears to have detained an 85-year-old California man who'd entered the country on a tourist visa last month. Some reports have named him as 85-year-old Merrill Newman, who was a veteran of the Korean War. Neighbours in the city of Palo Alto have told Reuters that they were worried about him after he travelled to North Korea but failed to return. The Dubai Air Show has been forced to close today after heavy winds and rain hit the region overnight. Participants who arrived early were evacuated amid flooding of the local roads connecting the air show site to the Dubai city centre. A spokesman for the US Air Force said there was no damage to the 12 US aircraft on display, as officials had moved the aircraft to a nearby maintenance facility late on Wednesday night in anticipation of the storm. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney. That was Barney Burnham. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Tighe Enright, and Victoria Graham. We start the programme with three stories that we'll be following throughout the day here on Monocle 24. I'm delighted to say that our agenda setter today is Amanda Goodall, the Senior Lecturer in Management at the Cass Business School here in London. Thanks for coming in to us, Amanda. The first story you've picked out for us today is the release on bail of nine of the Arctic 30 Greenpeace activists. Why have you chosen this story?
Well, it seems like a very topical story, especially given what's been happening in the rise in extreme weather events in the Philippines. But obviously, these people have been in prison for 2 months. I'm not quite sure of the history, but I think that it's rare for Greenpeace activists to be imprisoned, especially for this amount of time. And I think in terms of the future, it made me think about what's going to happen to activists in the future. If we think about in the terms of the Philippines, we've just had one diplomat who put himself on a hunger strike because of what happened in the Philippines. And one can envisage a world in the future of increasing number of activists as these extreme events happen. And how are governments going to cope with this? What's going to happen? Is it just going to be us and them? That's the reason that I'm picking up on this story. And apart from anything, the great news about some of them receiving bail. Now, the truth is that we don't know what's going to happen when they after their trial, whether they're going to be imprisoned. They still can be on this charge of hooliganism. But it's really the bigger picture. I think about the bigger picture, what's going to happen.
I mean, some people could still face up to seven years in prison for this hooliganism. But, I mean, some haven't been released on bail at all. And I'm slightly confused by that, Amanda. I mean, I think 20 of the 30 have been released. But this poor Colin Russell, who's a 59-year-old Australian, he's had his detention extended.
Yes.
I mean, why is that, one wonders?
I don't know. They didn't give any information. In fact, when you try and read into the story, I looked at these in depth last night and also this morning, and there's really not a lot other than just that they were given bail.
I suppose the concerning thing, is it all too easy? Does this arrest, does their ordeal heighten the environmental cause? Or is there a danger that, you know, we forget what actually they're protesting about and suddenly it becomes a kind of a West versus Russia diplomatic spat?
That's true. Yes, of course. And we know that they were protesting against what's going on in the Arctic Circle, that there's oil mining going on. And they were particularly campaigning against Shell, actually, who were the organisation there. And no doubt the deals that have been struck behind the scene will give this lot bail if you give something to us. I mean, of course, that's what will be going on. We all know that. And we'll never know exactly what the details of those negotiations are.
Amanda, let's move on to one of your other stories, and this is about mammograms can help and harm. Talk us through this.
Yeah, I thought this was very interesting. This is a US story. There is a doctor who's at Dartmouth College, who's a professor of medicine called Gilbert Welch, and he's written a book called Overdiagnosed, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health. He uses as an example in his article breast cancer mammograms. Of course, this issue's been in the media a lot recently. Angelina Jolie had the double mastectomy. And then there was a TV anchor, Amy Robach, who had a mammogram done in front of 5 million TV viewers. And she ended up, after the mammogram, having a double mastectomy also. What I think he's trying to raise is the problem that we know in UK data particularly, and I think this is probably the same in the States, I'm not sure about the rest of the world, that breast cancer rates are rising. And he's just trying to alert us to the problem of over diagnosis. And what that means basically is that just to give you some numbers here, in the UK, the NHS will actually tell you that for every woman saved, that means that really genuinely had a serious cancer, three women are overdiagnosed. And that means they will have had chemotherapy, they may have had a lumpectomy, they will have had radiotherapy. And he reckons that it could be, the number of false positives could be as high as 10 to 1, although that's disputed. And it's very difficult to know exactly.
What's he suggesting is the background to all this? Is it that, as you talk about false positives, is it that benign tumours are coming back, being tested as malignant, as dangerous? Or is it that, breast cancer and other cancers have become such a scary word that you only have to mention the concept of a lump and some patients might think just, go for the extreme measure?
Absolutely. And we do know that breast cancer is a particularly nasty kind of cancer. I mean, I'm no expert on this, but obviously it can spread very quickly and very harmfully. I think what he's drawing attention to also is as we come, I remember talking to someone recently saying that I was 52 and should I be, going out and having more tests and things. And this person said, who was medically trained, said, it's a really, really good idea not to go and look for things, because if you go and look for things, you'll find them. Now, whether we can tell you on the surface, even with some diagnosis, whether what we've found is very, very serious, we don't know. And I suppose what he's advocating is that women who find lumps actually themselves, these are important lumps and these should be tested, but actually going and looking for them, and especially as it increases the amount of radiation and, of course, the treatment as well. That can be, are we doing the right thing here?
OK, let's go on to your final story, and quite a big one. It's Paul Flowers, who's still making the headlines from the Cooperative Bank.
Just explain for viewers, or for listeners, I should say, outside of Britain, why Paul Flowers is in the news.
Yes, well, Paul Flowers, who's now called the Crystal Methodist Banker, and that relates to the fact that he got caught trying to buy some crystal meths recently. Basically, he's someone who's been involved in the co-op industry for quite a long time. In 2010, he was made chairman of the Co-op Bank. The Co-op Bank is still a large British bank. Unfortunately, prior to that, the Co-op took over Britannia Building Society, which was a nice little mutual. And a mutual, if people don't know, is something that's run under different terms and with shareholders, so it's more collectively owned like the Co-op.
But it made a lot of blunders, and it's landed itself with an awful lot of toxic loans that it's recovering from. All
exactly.
The while, we now know that its chairman was on Class A's.
Well,
that's
not the issue for me. I mean, if he wants to take drugs in his private life, I'm sure there's many bankers in this city that do that regularly, but I won't mention any names.
And some wouldn't find that particularly surprising.
No, absolutely. But my issue here is one that relates to my research, which is when I first came on your fine radio program, in fact, and that is to talk about leaders. Are leaders being hired because they have understanding about the core business? It turns out that Paul Flowers knows nothing about banking. He has never spent any of his career in banking, and he was made chairman of one of Britain's biggest banks. If you look at other banks like the Halifax Bank of Scotland, which is now currently owned by the British taxpayers. Also, that was led, the CEO was someone called Andy Hornby. He'd come from the grocer industry. He was just over 12 when he took over. I mean, he was literally about in his late 30s. He had no experience in banking. The point I'm making here is, what qualifications do leaders have when they run these massive organisations? How many other bankers in the city are leading these institutions without having real banking qualifications, without having a history of knowing about banking?
And indeed now, as the banking industry is becoming more risky again in terms of getting into derivative-based products, you know, are the successors to the banking leaders of the past any more au fait with what these products actually mean?
Well, exactly. And I think this is the point, really. The Financial Services Authority, which is now defunct and has been given another name in the hope that it might go away, they actually met this guy, Paul Flowers. They actually interviewed him. And this is still going on today. There was another head of a bank interviewed a couple of days ago, and he was talking about the importance of diversity. And I thought, that's great. He's talking about diversity. That's really important. Let's look a bit into him. Well, it turns out he's talking about diversity because he doesn't know anything about banking. He'd come from the army. So I don't think anything's changed. I think these things are still going on. That's important.
The only good bit of news is that I've got 10% off my next Co-op shop as a result of being a Co-op card member. So thank you, Mr. Flowers, for that. But otherwise,
sigh of relief coming from across the studio here.
Amanda, it's really good to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for coming. Senior lecturer in management at the Cass Business School. You're joining us on Midori House.
Coming up, we'll unpick a new report that casts the so-called act of price tagging by Israeli settlers towards their Palestinian neighbours under the spotlight. Stay with us.
The Monocle Book Tour has touched down in the warmer parts of the globe, and this November we'll be packing the snowshoes and chilling out in the Nordic region. Starting on November the 18th in Stockholm and taking in a different country each day, we'll be shooting through Oslo and Copenhagen before ending up in Helsinki on the 21st, and we'll be bringing you live shows right here on Monocle 24 from each stop along the way. So if you want to hear how the Monocle Guide to Better Living is going down in the snowier parts of Europe, point your mouse towards book.monocle.com and be sure to tune in to Nordic Leg of the Monocle Book Tour this November on Monocle 24.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, they're part of what's become known as price tag gangs. What started out as young Jewish people making their point with graffiti, but one that's evolved in sinister form to arson attacks and religious desecration. The perpetrators suggest they're warning shots, revenge against the government for what they see as the giving away of Jewish lands to the Palestinians.
Instances of price tagging, mainly against Arab and left-wing targets and sometimes Israeli security forces, are becoming increasingly prominent. A report suggests the number of attacks has tripled between 2007 and 2011. But what or who really motivates these acts of defiance, and what, if anything, can be done about it? Well, joining us now is Marika Peters, Monocle's correspondent in Ramallah, who's seen an early copy of this report. Marika, thank you for joining us. Can you just explain to us exactly what price tagging is and a bit of this history?
Yeah, well, the report which is coming out today was written by the International Crisis Group, which is defining price tagging as measures of revenge intimidation and deterrence. And basically, prize tagging is the name which is given to acts of violence, which, as you said, can include graffiti or the burning of olive trees is also a good example, which are mostly carried out by Israeli settlers living in the West Bank on Palestinian or Arab targets, both within Israel and within the West Bank. And it's, as you said, it's a way of leaving a mark. But it's not just about expressing anger towards the Palestinians themselves. It's also about frustration with the state, and it's called price tagging because it's what the settlers say is the price that the state has to pay for not protecting the settler movement, for example, dismantling settlements, which isn't often done, but there are threats for that to be done sometimes, or for not taking stronger measures against Palestinians who carry out attacks on settlers. So this is where the name comes from.
I suppose you think of, you know, tagging is something that's associated with graffiti and other types of vandalism. It doesn't hurt many people. But how serious has this practice become? How much has it evolved? Could we get to a point where people start getting hurt physically?
Well, let me give you some examples of recent price tag attacks. As you said, some of them do involve graffiti. But, we've had examples of graffiti scrawled on a cemetery in Jaffa, which is part of Tel Aviv. We've also had graffiti in one of the most famous Christian monasteries here in near Jerusalem called Latrun. Stone throwing, obviously, is very dangerous. And chopping down olive trees, you're destroying people's livelihoods. I'll talk about, whether we can consider it terrorism or not in a moment. But first of all, let's just hear from Moshi Hasdai and his son, David. Now, David's an 18-year-old who lives in the settlement of Beit El next to Ramallah. And he was arrested for being involved or alleged involvement in a price tag attack on that monastery, which I just mentioned. They both feel that they should, the Israelis and the settlement movement in particular, should be in charge of the whole country. So settlements are a step towards that. And they explained to me what it is that motivates people like David to get involved with this kind of activity in the first place.
It's a sort of a voice from inside that you cannot resist it, because you see in front of your eyes for 10 years or so, maybe 15 years, that the Arabs win in every dimension they choose. And they do it without justice. They do it with violence and brutality. And so when they win every battle, something comes from inside and says, okay, so at least we protest. And this is a protest movement only. I ate my nails and the nails in my feet, and I took off my hair for a few times. I do not sleep for a few years like I used to be before he began his activities.
Yes. So it worries you, but you still...
It worries me a lot.
But you're okay with it carrying on, even though it worries you?
I'm more than satisfied. I think that he is a hero. And his friends are heroes. They took measures in times that the government is weak and obsessively surrendering to any blackmail from the enemy.
Marika, what are the main questions that this report raises then?
Well, the report raises the question of particularly who is encouraging these young people to get involved in this kind of attack. As we just heard, Moshe himself, it seems to be supporting his son's activities, whether or not he was responsible for that particular incident. There's a lot of focus on how much religious leaders are doing to prevent this kind of thing. And also, there's a lot of talk as well about whether the police can be doing better to eradicate it, and whether more stronger measures need to be taken, whether it needs to be defined as terrorism because it terrorizes a section of the population, and how that will all play into any eventual peace deal and how it should be addressed in terms of that.
Okay, Marika Peters, our correspondent in Ramallah, thanks for joining us.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
the wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a Bunga Bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're at 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. And a guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
You're listening to Midori House. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we can head to Nairobi, and our correspondent there is Tristan McConnell. Tristan, thanks so much for joining us. Let's go to your first story of the day. And Joseph Kony, who we may know his whereabouts, and he may be willing to surrender.
Yeah, I think lots of conditionals there. There's some reports been coming out of the Central African Republic over the last 24 hours or so that the president, the interim president of that country, a rebel leader who has installed himself in State House, has been in communication with the other leader, Joseph Kony, who may possibly be in the mood to surrender. But I think that it's been greeted with, on the one hand, you know, some hope that we may see an end to the scourge of the Lord's Resistance Army, which, you know, it began operating in the mid-80s and is still a dangerous threat to civilians across Central Africa, but also with a degree of skepticism, partly because we've seen these talks before, most recently in 2006 when South Sudan tried to broker a peace talks and the surrender for Joseph Kony, and that fell apart, and previously with Uganda, and each time Joseph Kony has sort of use the lull in fighting that the peace talks have offered to sort of regroup, to you know, resupply and begin his fighting again. But I think there's also an important element here on the Central African Republic side, and we've talked about this over the last recent months. The problems in that country are really spiraling out of control. The sectarian nature of the conflict is becoming increasingly clear, and the government of President Michel Djotodia, it has very little control, and this would, you know, claiming to be able to broker peace talks with one of the world's most wanted men might win him some much-needed sort of brownie points with the international community.
Tristan,
so I think we need to see how this one plays out.
Moving to Eastern Congo, Tristan, and some government soldiers have gone on trial for the alleged mass rape of 100 women. How long has it taken us to reach this point for them to reach face justice?
Well, almost exactly a year, actually. I was in Eastern Congo a year ago when M23 rebels took over the town of Goma and pushed the army out. When the army was retreating, it sort of rolled through this little town of Manova on the lakeshore, and allegedly a huge number of women were raped as they went on a kind of horrible rampage, drinking and stealing and sort of predatory behavior towards the civilians, which was really very much part of the modus operandi of the Congolese army at the time. The reason this is significant is we're actually seeing some soldiers being charged. The court case is underway. It's slightly disappointing that we don't have many senior officers. They're all fairly low-ranking soldiers who are being charged here. But, you know, rape has been used by all sides in Congo's conflicts over the last couple of decades. So this is an important step that perhaps is being taken more seriously, and perhaps there will be some form of justice for the victims of this horrendous violence.
And Tristan, let's go to Kenya's Special Anti-Terrorism Police Unit, because they've actually been praised with providing a robust counter-terrorism response, but at the same time, they've been criticised quite heavily, haven't they?
Yeah, they certainly have. There was a report that came out this week put together by a Mombasa-based Muslim human rights group and the Open Society Justice Initiative, which looked at alleged abuses, you know, torture, beatings, disappearances, extrajudicial killings carried out by the ATPU. And we've seen these sorts of allegations before, but in the wake of the Westgate attack in September, they've risen to the surface once again, and pressure has been put on America and Britain to cease their funding of the anti-terrorism police unit until these issues are dealt with. I think the really serious problem here, though, is that the way that the ATPU cares to behave, its sort of brutal response towards Muslims and particularly ethnic Somalis, there are very serious worries that it plays into the hands of the extremists because it simply turns people away from the government and towards groups such as al-Shabaab.
Tristan McConnell in Nairobi, thanks for that.
In the next half an hour of the programme, we'll hear of a renewal underway in the bookbinding trade and bring you part four of our week-long series on soft power. But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Victoria. French authorities have named the man they've arrested on suspicion of carrying out a series of gun attacks in Paris. Abdelhakim Dekar was arrested in a car park in the northwest of the capital on Wednesday evening following a tip-off from the public. Thousands of Afghan elders are meeting in Kabul to discuss the country's future relations with the United States. America's threatening to withdraw all staff, not just combat forces, at the end of next year unless Afghan officials agree to give them immunity from prosecution. Talks resume today between world powers and Iran on the country's nuclear program. Tehran's being offered limited sanctions relief in exchange for a deal to restrict the program. There's tight security outside Australia's embassy in Jakarta, where protesters have gathered amidst growing anger over reports that Canberra spied on top Indonesians, including the president and his wife. It's been reported that North Korea appears to have detained an 85-year-old California man who'd entered the country on a tourist visa last month. Some reports have named him as 85-year-old Merrill Newman, who was a veteran of the Korean War. The Dubai Air Show has been forced to close for the day after heavy winds and rain hit the region overnight. Participants who arrived early were evacuated amid flooding of the local roads which connected the site of the show to the city centre. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney. It's 10:32 in Beirut and 9:32 in Madrid and 8:32 here in London. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Victoria Graham, and Tadhg Enright. Now, in this week's series, we are taking a look at soft power superstars around the world to coincide with Monocle's annual soft power survey. Nations are increasingly trying to get what they want through attraction rather than coercion, looking beyond military might to exert a more nuanced influence on the world stage. Well-known figures and brands serve as one means of garnering global attention.
Well, today we look to Spain, which recently celebrated its annual Prince of Asturias Awards in the northern city of Oviedo. Spain's equivalent to the Nobel Prize, a lavish affair in which the country bestows 10 luminaries or distinguished associations from 10 distinct fields with a prestigious award. Now, as the annual ceremonies become increasingly global in scope, the recognition of international excellence has become a more subtle way of proclaiming Spain's values and its evolving identity to the world. This year, our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, was invited along to the royal proceedings and found himself asking the question, can a country increase its soft power simply by association?
No, I'm not in Scotland, but in northern Spain, in the picturesque city of Oviedo, which also has a deep affection for the musical power of the bagpipe. They're out in force today, as Asturianos, lining the streets in traditional dress, have rolled out the red carpet for some very distinguished guests. It's the time of year when the world comes to this otherwise peaceful corner of the globe, a time when Spain's king-in-waiting, Don Felipe, the Prince of Asturias, returns to the region to bestow the highest order of the land to 10 national and international laureates.
It helps spread some ideas that are not well known in Spain. We get to know two very important thinkers on social politics. We get to know great artists that are not big in Spain yet. And these awards give them a profile in our country and people get to know them, so their ideas get well known and their power is stronger in Spain.
At the busy gala luncheon, not far from the royal delegation and its unusually big security entourage, I'm talking to Paco Polo, the Spanish director of Change.org. He's telling me how he believes the awards provide a soft power platform for the laureates to promote their values and ideas. However, he also thinks the lavish ceremony and the week of seminars and public events that precede it are the perfect vehicle to reinforce a long tradition of sponsoring soft power that stretches back centuries.
I think that the monarchy in Spain, even if they are under heavy fire at this very moment, they have been always very interested in knowing about culture, about science, and they have been fostering and promoting science knowledge and artists in our country. So I think this is completely aligned with their work. The same way the Nobel Prize puts a country in the world map, the Premio Príncipe de Asturias puts Spain in this map. It helps to show that Spain is concerned about this kind of issues, that it's interested in spreading the word and the work that these people are doing.
But can a country simply gain soft power credibility by aligning itself with esteemed thinkers, artists, and scientists from around the globe? Is there such a thing as soft power by association? This year, the category winners include Austrian filmmaker Michael Haneke, American photographer Annie Leibovitz, and the Dutch sociologist Saskia Sassen, who has been impressed by the finesse of the foundation.
What was surprising, not just to me, but also to Annie Leibovitz and a few others, is the way they organized it. The way they organized it was that you were here. In a way that, you know, I can go to Beijing and be there for a day and not be there. I'm just basically giving a talk on a podium and it doesn't matter. Secondly, there was a kind of depth, a seriousness. This was not a party. This was a collective project. The whole town was mobilized. They are witnesses. You take it seriously. So this is a kind of soft power that is far more sophisticated than the usual meaning.
Saskia has been busy embarking on a bit of soft power maneuvering herself, donating her prize money to an unrelated union protest that has been struggling quite loudly to have its voice heard on the streets outside. However, today, all eyes are on the Crown Prince, who gives his most important speech of the year.
Y ofrecemos una imagen muy alejada del pesimismo que tantas veces...
As the King-in-Waiting, his words have been largely tailored to a domestic audience, making strong overtures to the hardships endured by Spaniards during the country's long economic crisis. It begs the question, is the ceremony really just an elaborate exercise to court public opinion in the Prince's favour? Matías Rodríguez Inciarte is the foundation's director.
Well, I think that this award that started 33 years ago are very well for the Crown Prince because it gives him an opportunity, first of all, to make a very important speech, and second, because it associates Spain with distinguished personalities all over the world.
Yet, it's not just about priming the prince for the throne, as the growing international notoriety of the event has proved.
The awards started being mostly Latin American, Iberian kind of awards, now are very much international. Sometimes we even preceded Nobel Prizes, like the case of Higgs and Engler this year. And in Spain, specifically in these moments, when we are living through a very deep crisis, I think it gives the idea of there are values of reference for the population that go beyond the circumstances very negative of the crisis.
The foundation recently launched a study into the international impact of the awards, analysing global media coverage and how it has positively affected Spain's image abroad. The results are yet to be released, but Matías provides an example of some recent blowback, which proved positive for bilateral relations at least.
When the Crown Prince of Japan was in Spain a number of months ago, he made a very powerful reference in his speech to the heroes of Fukushima that were awarded one of the prizes of the foundation. So for Japanese people, were a matter of pride to be associated with the Prince of Asturias Awards. And the repercussion in the case of Japan was enormous.
The jury may still be out on how much the awards are affecting hearts and minds, but for actual jury member Bernardo Hernández, there are tangible benefits for Spain's soft power brand. He was recently named by tech giant Yahoo to lead Flickr in the United States. And from his vantage point across the Atlantic, he believes Spain has a strong underlying position to project soft power.
Spain has been a very global country in many reasons. Like our language is one of the top languages in the world. our culture has influence in, you know, big parts of, you know, South America, Central America, you know, Southeast Asia. I think the projection of the global projection of Spain, I think, is a strong value that is reflected on this award.
Perhaps the sum of a country's soft power is more than the collective efforts of its cultural ambassadors. In Spain's case, going beyond the unmistakable power of its daring filmmakers and delicious tapas, and by recognizing esteemed talent from around the world, it is making a bold declaration about its own national values and principles. And in doing so, it is not only setting the bar high for itself, but commending other nations for doing the same. For Monocle in Oviedo, I'm Liam Aldous.
Don't forget to pick up the latest edition of the Monocle magazine, which includes our annual soft power survey. We take a look at 30 countries who best attract favour from others through culture, sport, cuisine, design, diplomacy and beyond.
It's 10:40 in Athens and 8:40 in London. You're listening to Midori House. Now, they say never judge a book by its cover. Well, that's the aim of a new exhibition in London, which is shining a light on the world of bookbinding. Beautiful Readable Objects is dedicated to making contemporary conservation bindings for damaged antiquarian books, enabling readers to appreciate history well into the future.
Antiquarian's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? But this is more than just a celebration of bookbinding. The show as the Aram Gallery aims to harness how traditional methods can be preserved for generations to come while exploring sustainable design and conservation. So put down that e-reader, tablet or Kindle or whatever brand you have, and just for a moment, let's appreciate the feel of what a beautifully bound book can offer. We'll be joined now to discuss this some more in the studio by Eloise Parker, the curator of the exhibition here in London on bookbinding trends all over the world. What do you think people who are uninitiated in the art of bookbinding are going to take away from this show?
Good morning. Hopefully, I think people will get a perspective of how contemporary bookbinding binders are working today. The exhibition aims to bring together 9 different participants from around the world who are part of a collective called Tomorrow's Past, and to really root the bindings that they have made in the now. These binders are not intending to imitate past conventions. They build on what is existing, but they do it in a very contemporary way.
Is this about preserving a dying art, a little bit like dry stone walling or something like that? I mean, is bookbinding still very much alive and well?
It is very much alive and well. It really, really is. It's not something that that, as you say, many people are aware of or understand, but it is a very, very vibrant community of people working.
Is it an evolving art? I mean, are there new practices creeping into it?
Absolutely. In particular, there's an exhibitor called Charles Gledhill who's in the exhibition, and he has sort of pioneered the use of polyester sheet, which we would refer to as just a cellophane wrapping, and he uses that within the binding of his book to enable a flexible and fully functioning opening.
Now the show talks about the collective Tomorrow's Past.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Tomorrow's Past are an international collective. They set up really to as a group of like-minded people who wanted to not create facsimiles or imitate antiquarian bookbinding techniques, but to really build on those techniques and update them using, as I said before, polyester sheet, for example.
So what makes, how can you tell what makes a well-bound book?
Primarily, it's got to function as an object, as a readable object. The works in the exhibition are fragile because of the use of materials such as vellum. But once you sort of handle them and get them open, they should sit flat and operate like a functional book.
Does your art feel under threat from the rise of digital consumption?
I don't think so. I think if one gets the opportunity to see one of these fantastically bound books in the flesh, you really do understand the strength and the value in the work done versus, as you said before, an e-reader.
There is nothing like holding a book, I
there
have
really
to say.
Isn't, no.
Lots of people have these new digital things. I don't, and I love the feel of a book in my hands. My mum used to be a librarian, and she would say that books are everything. So it is important to preserve these books, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. That's the sort of underlying manifesto of Tomorrow's Past, is to preserve and to conserve and to repair for future generations, but to root it in the now.
Now, Eloise, I've handed you there
you have?
Copy. It's on in all good bookshops. Well, it's all available from the Monocle shop, I should say. The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's our first bookish publication.
Yep.
What do you think of its binding?
I
be
think
kind.
It's lovely. I do love a texture on the front, so it's a nice material you've used to cover the boards. And also, when I'm opening it here at the sort of middle pages, it does lie flat, which is one of the most important things, especially for something such as a coffee table book as this. It must function.
What can you tell us about the people who have put that together? Because I understand that you can tell an awful lot about a person who's bound a book.
One can. You can't tell too much about the stitching without looking in much detail, and unfortunately I don't have such a trained eye that I would be able to assess who has bound it, but these end papers being pasted down is sort of hiding quite a few of the secrets, which is not something that we'll be doing in the exhibition. You'll be able to see exactly how each of these books has been bound.
Okay, and so tell us about the range of exhibits which are part of this exhibition.
Tomorrow's Past have a manifesto that they have to select books which are only damaged. That means that the boards are missing, or the stitching has been ruined, or the book paper, the book stack is vulnerable. So most of the works that we're showing have been repaired in such a way that you can't really tell that they have been repaired. They're very, very contemporary, updated.
Eloise, it's fascinating. Good luck with the show. Thank you so
Thank
much
you
for
much.
Coming
Thank
in.
You.
That was Eloise Park, a curator at the Aram Gallery. Thanks very much for joining us on Midori House.
Thank
well,
you.
In a moment, we'll be heading for a flick through the day's Brazilian newspapers. Before all that, though, some music with a Brazilian sound. Secos e Malhados with Flores Astrais. Here's their, here's their performance. How do I pronounce that, Fernando?
Secos e molhados with flores astrais, or astro flowers.
You see, you said I did a good job before the song. I think you were lying.
I think you did an okay job, Ty.
And if you were to look that up on your favourite video viewing website, their video, it's a 1974 performance, and they're quite interesting.
Impressive outfits.
Very impressive.
Or lack of outfits.
Impressive. And if you imagine, that's 74, and then you see like artists like Lady Gaga, and you see, oh, what an interesting outfit. But they've done it in 74 already.
They were
already.
Way ahead of their time.
Way
ahead.
Weren't they? Have you seen the metallic tongue as well?
So. You're listening to Midori House, and as you can hear, Fernando Augusto Pacheco has joined us with some of the newspaper headlines. What have you got for us today, Fernando?
Well, let's start with O Globo. You know, I'm sorry, but until next year, I'll keep talking about the World Cup. That's the way life is. Yeah, well, that's, you know, because yesterday was defined the list of the 32 countries that would take place, that will go to the next year's World Cup in Brazil. Uruguay and Mexico managed to classify at the last minute. But there's also been an interesting discussion at the Brazilian press, well, not only the Brazilian press, that there should be more African and Asian teams at the World Cup at the moment. Because the division at the moment is like 6 countries from South America, 13 from Europe, 4 from Central and North America, 5 from Africa, and 4 from Asia. Of course, football is more kind of popular in Europe and South America, but I think other countries, like especially in Asia and in Africa, I think they deserve like a more space, because there's like a proportionate number of European countries, in my opinion at least.
But is this about kind of positive discrimination almost? Will some teams be getting through who might not really put on a great performance for the viewers because it's just not their cup of tea?
That's really a very good point. That's a very good point. But this, as I said, it's still just discussions. Nothing has been decided yet.
And we're looking forward to it nevertheless in 2014.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We'll be
yeah.
glued to the televisions and radios.
And there's also
I won't.
Next story you have for us, a sunny holiday in Brazil yesterday.
Sunny holiday, but as you can see in the picture, well, it was not very nice. It's a picture at Arpoador Beach in Rio. It's a very touristic beach, central Rio de Janeiro. You know, there was a gang yesterday. They started attacking tourists in the middle of the beach. You know, they usually go like in gangs of 10 or more, and they go and rob from everyone. But then, as you can see here, the police is beating them up. And because yesterday was a holiday in Brazil, it was the Black Awareness Day. And because it became like a national holiday less than 5 years ago, because now Brazil's trying to kind of, especially because of our terrible past of slavery and everything, we're trying to...
And what generally happens on a day, on a Black Awareness Day?
Well, of course, there's lots of events, you know, but you know, it is a national holiday, and it was like more than 30 degrees in Rio, so people, they do go to the beach. Okay. And actually, as you know, in Brazil, we have so many national holidays, especially when you compare to, like, to England or the US. We have, I believe, around 15 or so.
Oh.
Wow. Goodness, look at you guys, you know how to party. I'm just looking at this photo on the cover of O Globo, and I'm sure everyone supports the notion of police clamping down on pickpocketing gangs, but goodness gracious, they've got like batons which are about three times the size of any baton I've seen before, and they're tossing deck chairs rather indiscriminately at, I'm guessing, sunbathers. They don't seem to be being very careful.
Not really. And it's been on the story as well that our Argentinian tourist was beaten in the eye as well. So there's been quite a lot of confusion in the beach, which is a shame, right? I mean, if you're visiting Rio and you want to relax.
Exactly.
Let's get to your next story, which is a Folha de São Paulo.
Exactly. And there's a very revealing picture. It's a prison of the... It's the picture of a prison called Papuda, which is basically where MPs José Dirceu, Delúbio Soares and José Genuíno, they were MPs, members of the Workers' Party. They were sentenced because of the Mensalão scandal, this huge corruption scandal in Brazil where MPs, they voted according to what the government said. So they're finally actually in prison at the moment, which they were arrested this week. And then there's been a lot of discussion because José Genuíno, he's still an MP. Mm. There's been discussion if he should remain as an MP or not. And also his health is very fragile at the moment. So I'm not sure if he'll stay in jail for such a long time. So it's, I mean, under control. So, but it's interesting that politicians are actually going to jail, because so far we talked about, oh, they're being sentenced, whatever. But now, as you can see, they are in jail. Mm. And a lot of their own MPs, they went to visit them in prison yesterday.
So what are we seeing in this picture here, Fernando? Is something...
That's where actually, you know, when the prisoners, they go for to sunbathe or
for
to
their
do
walk.
Some sports. Exactly. So that's the picture of the prison here of Papuda.
Okay, and the final story.
Yes,
more
sport. More sport.
I mean, I have to mention this briefly, but you know, it's
do I sound like I like sport?
No, you sound as exasperated, perhaps. I was going to say bored, but I'm not going to go there.
But that's,
sport's not my thing, guys.
That's like a business story as well.
Oh, okay, you know, business.
Formula,
I like business.
Formula One is still quite big in Brazil, not as popular as it was in the 90s because of our great racer Ayrton Senna, which is a national hero in Brazil. But it's still it brings a lot of business to the city of São Paulo. It's actually our main touristic event. After that is the Gay Pride. But the Gay Pride and the Formula One Grand Prix, they're the huge, huge events. All the hotels, they get booked, 100% booked. So that's why it's the last race of the year as well.
And it's people are looking forward to a bonanza with the race coming up, or
absolutely. Even though we don't have great Brazilian racers at the moment, so that's quite sad.
Okay, but Fernando, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave
thank
it there.
You very
thanks
much
as ever for coming in to talk to us. Well, at 1200 hours London time here in Monocle 24, the briefing concludes its week-long tour of the Nordic world. It's been in the capitals of Sweden, Norway and Denmark. Today, they're in the Finnish capital, Helsinki. And to tell us what's ahead on this final day of the tour is our very own Finn, Marcus Hippi. I love trying to pronounce your name properly, Marcus. How did I do?
You did really well. You are learning gradually. It wasn't that amazing in the beginning, but definitely better now. I'm being brutally honest, as the Finns are, you know. I'm sitting on a sofa in one of my favorite book and magazine shops. It is in Helsinki. It is called Akateeminen Kirjakauppa, and we have an event here today. It's been quite a busy week, you know. Even if you live in the Nordic countries, in one of them, you don't normally go through four capitals in 4 days, but that's exactly what we've been doing. We started indeed from Stockholm on Monday, went forward to Oslo, Copenhagen yesterday and Helsinki today. We've met amazing people, including the most popular TV host in Scandinavia, Fredrik Skavlan. In Sweden, we met editor-in-chief of Sweden's biggest newspaper, Peter Wolodarski. And yesterday in Copenhagen, Puv Bert, who has been producing some of the biggest crime drama TV series in Denmark, was our guest, and so on. And indeed, today we are in my hometown. It's not in November. It's not the best time to come to Finland, to be honest. The weather is a bit crap, but at the same time, people are even friendlier, and it's quite nice to sit inside and have a nice coffee. Indeed, in this bookshop where I am at the moment, we are hosting an event at 6 o'clock. I'm going to be on the stage with Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and our editor, Andrew Tuck, interviewing them for 20 minutes or so. So you Finns out there listening, just come and pop by.
Good, so what's going to be on the briefing today?
And then indeed the briefing in about, 3 hours? Well, we meet Alexander Stubb, who's Finnish Minister of European Affairs and Foreign Trade. I get to meet one of my favourite ambassadors ever for second time. Actually, last time when I was in Helsinki doing a show, we met him for the first time. American ambassador to Finland, Bruce Orek, who's got an amazing style in his diplomacy. He is very easily approachable. Finns love him. And he doesn't seem to take himself that seriously, you know. A few years ago, he posed in a Finnish magazine, topless, with no shirt on. And, well, obviously, he looked all right, considering that he's a bodybuilder.
Marcus, apart from that, what's been the highlight of your tour?
Well, I mentioned some names already there. So indeed, for example, yesterday, Copenhagen, it was amazing to speak to those people who've actually created the success of Nordic crime drama. Those people actually came up with the ideas and managed to turn that into an international success story. Some great media people in Sweden and so on. I think I have to say that actually this Helsinki show, maybe partly I'm biased obviously being from here, but I have to say I'm really excited about the lineup we have on today's program. I gave you a couple of names already, but we also, for example, are going to meet the founder of Jolla, which is a Finnish company that's been created relatively recently after Nokia started going seriously downhill. Some ex-Nokia people decided to put up their own mobile phone company, and that company is going to launch their first phone next week, and they're talking about how they see, how they feel mobile phones should be done. They think Nokia probably did something wrong. And we also meet Roman Schatz, who's a German guy who's been living here for who knows how long. He's our favourite foreigner in Finland. He's great how he talks about the Finnish mentality. And he is going to be the right person to explain to you all what's going on in my head.
To hear about it, Marcus. And so we're going to have to cut you off because otherwise we're running out of time. You can hear that at midday here in London. But that's all we have time for today. Our producer was Thomas Lewis. Research by Barbara Feeney, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rosie Sells. Our studio manager was Alex Funnel.
And don't forget, at midday UK time, so in 3 hours from now, the briefing draws its tour of 4 Nordic nations to a close with a special edition from the Finnish capital, Helsinki. That's the briefing at 1200 hours London time.
After the news, it's Culture with Robert Bound.
And we'll be back with Clemency Burton-Hill for tomorrow's edition of Midori House. That's at 8 o'clock London time. But for now, from me, Victoria Graham.
And from me, Ty Genwright, it's goodbye and thank you for listening.
Goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.